Blog Talk Radio.
And I will be your host today. Joining me is Nell Cole, the producer of Fire Talk Productions, and David Little Eagle, also another host. Today we're going to be speaking with Walter Little Moon and his life partner, Jane Ridgway. Right from their website, I'm going to read right off their website, thickdarkfog.com. Walter Little Moon attended a federal Indian boarding school in the South Dakota 60 years ago. The mission of many of these schools in the 1950s was to kill the Indian and save the man. The child was not allowed to be Indians, to speak their language or express their culture or native identity in any way, at the risk of being severely beaten, humiliated, or abused. What effects did these actions cause? Many Indians, like Walter, live with this unresolved trauma into adulthood, acting it out through alcoholism and domestic violence. At age 58, Walter write and publish his memoirs in a way to explain his past abusive behaviors to his estranged children. But dealing with the memories of his boarding school days nearly put an end to it. The Thick Dark Fog tells the story of how Walter confronts the thick dark fog of his past so that he could renew himself and his community. Now, Walter experienced what many, many of our people have gone through. I feel Walter in his story because Walter has had the courage to face it and speak out. And he did that not only to help himself, but he did that to reach out to his children, and he did that to explain what his life was. A very important person who helped Walter bring this forth was his life partner, Jane Ridgway. With that said, I want to bring Jane on, and the first question I want to ask Jane is to tell us a little bit about herself and how her and Walter come to meet. So, Jane, welcome to Fire Talk.
Hi, thank you very much. You want to know the beginning of our life together or our
sure.
friendship. It actually began 28 years ago when a man in my town was, back in Connecticut, was doing a clothing drive that a friend of mine got involved with. And he had advertised that the Indians on the Pine Ridge Reservation were dying from the cold and starving from hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, our town and the surrounding areas were very generous to him, but he didn't move the items out that he had collected. Instead, he filled two classrooms in an empty school building in our town, floor to ceiling, with donations. So my friend came to me crying about it, and I went to see him, and I said, it's 2 months have gone by. You started in February. It's February of 1984,
mm-hmm.
and now it's April. Why aren't you moving the clothes? And he said, because I am the Moses of the Indians. And I'm not going to move these until I can fill 18 18-wheelers, and I'm going to drive in the lead truck.
Sure.
So that indicated to me that we were dealing with a very unstable person.
Yeah.
And that he, in turn, was not only giving our town a bad name, but he was not helping people who were in dire need. I myself didn't know much at all about Indian history or modern day Indians because in Connecticut at that time and during my upbringing, our Indian history taught in our school system pretty much ended 300 years before with the last tribes that were recognized. So it was all new to me. I spent 9 months teaching myself, reading about modern-day Indians, meeting with people, talking to people, and at the same time trying to find a way, an avenue to help the people on Pine Ridge that this man had involved us with. And I kept saying, we have to find someone of them helping his own people. Because I don't trust large organizations. I, for example, had looked behind Save the Children, and where they had a cute little log cabin building on a country road in Wilton, Connecticut. Their actual headquarters were very fancy on Madison Avenue in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And the natives who were making jewelry were getting for them to sell, we're getting very little money. So as time went by, I ran out of the house one night to pick up some milk in a 7-Eleven store. And when I walked down the store aisle, a magazine fell off the shelf. It was called Earthwatch magazine. And it fell open to a small article that said, Indian man helping his own. And it was so bizarre. It was an article about Walter.
What's the chances of that? Or like astronomical?
Well, the chances of that are so mind blowing.
So,
you
met Walter through words before you actually met him in person.
Right. It was just that was a strange way. It at that time, even though he had been born and raised in Wounded Knee on this reservation, he was living in Denver, Colorado, and he was bringing in supplies to the people here and helping them. So I called him, and that was the beginning. We had very long conversations on the phone because I wanted to know, what the problem was, what had happened, what created this situation. And he was coming to New England that following March on a speaking engagement from interest that had been generated by that article. And he said to me, I'll meet you anytime, any place, the first week in March. And I thought, well, what do you do? Meet him at a coffee shop on the interstate? I don't think so.
Right.
So I invited him to my house. And he came with one other fellow, and they stayed for 3 days and three nights. And I think that we talked nonstop for 48 hours.
Wow.
I just, it was the most incredible rapport between the two of us. Here we had been raised in two very different environments, and yet we saw eye to eye on so many things. So that was the beginning. I helped Walter from Connecticut, he in Denver, to help the people on Wounded Knee, in Wounded Knee, for several years, gathering supplies or going, meeting with different people. We went into, in 1990, I met him in Washington, and we went up before the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs to present problems to them. It was a serious relationship that we had. And then both of us eventually got burnt out and stopped for a while, lost contact with each other for a couple of years. And by the time we contacted each other again, we were both single. And that was 15 years ago.
Wow.
So
when you first met Walter and he came to your home, you invited him, and he came to your home. At this point, you did not know that he was a survivor of the residential schools. Is that correct?
Not at all, and
okay.
Neither did he, really. I mean, he knew where he had been to school, but he didn't think of himself at all as a survivor.
Gotcha. So what was your first impression, not knowing that he was a survivor and him himself not realizing yet that he was a survivor? What was your first impression of Walter?
That he was a very serious, somber man,
mm-hmm.
and that it was very difficult to get him to laugh or really loosen up. He was stiff. I thought it was just that his whole focus was on helping the people on his reservation, and because it was quite apparent. I came out here for the first time in 1985, and it was quite apparent that there were a lot of people here who were in a depression. The look on the faces that I saw were very familiar to me. In the New York metropolitan area, there were a lot of Holocaust survivors. I dated one of them and was friends with another who were, both slightly older than me. They're in the but still was, they were children during the Holocaust and in concentration camps, and it left a mark on them. They were both doctors. Coincidentally, the one ended up going to from Connecticut down to a Navajo reservation where he committed suicide. The other stayed in Connecticut and practiced medicine, but it was the same look.
Yep.
And so both Walter and I felt that what he wanted to do was spark a sense of self-worth in the people. And so we tried to come up with different ideas. He had, at the time that I first met him, he was bringing in supplies to have a community Christmas. It would be the first. He wanted to bring the people in the community out of their homes. They were no longer close to each other. He thought that it had been the last straw for this community was the 1973 occupation, where AIM came in and literally destroyed this community. It was unfortunate because they were focused on bringing attention to Indian problems, but in turn they didn't realize that they were destroying the community they had taken over. So he felt that that was, that the people were now leery of each other and they weren't talking, they weren't getting together like they had when he was a child. So he, the first thing was the Christmas. And he brought in supplies. He brought in the dinner. He held it in the basement of the Catholic Church at the massacre site, because that was the largest area that they had to meet in. And the people appreciated it. It wasn't a fancy Christmas. There were simple things for the elderly. There were simple, there were primarily toys for the children. And then he did the same thing again for Easter. He had an Easter egg hunt. He gathered up used bicycles and fixed them up so they could be prizes. There were toys again for the children. And in between time, he was bringing in extra food supplies. He was bringing in furniture where people might need furniture, anything. But all of those years of trying to spark, and it still wasn't connecting. What did connect was when I moved out here with him, and I saw how disconnected everyone was, and I said, let's research your family tree and see what we can come up with. Sometimes when you look at who you came from, you know, it gives you a sense of belonging.
Absolutely.
And one of his nephews found an interview that had been done by a doctor in 1926 with Walter's great-grandmother. She was a Northern Cheyenne woman, a Shahila, her name is Iron Teeth. And at that point of time, she was 92 years old. And I said, look at this. She died just before, about 10 years before Walter was born. And I said, you've got her interview taking you from her childhood in the 1830s and add your life onto it, and you've got over 100 years of your family history.
Wow.
Let's write down your memories and tack it onto hers. It sounded like a simple idea.
Now, that's in the book as well, right? That whole, I did read some of that.
Yeah.
That's in his book.
Yeah.
Incredible history.
Well, that was opening up a kettle of worms.
Well, after hearing so much so far, Jane, I can tell you that what the Native residential schools took from generations of children and out of our nations, they certainly didn't take Walter's compassion or love from him.
No, they didn't. And I and Walter truly believe that there is such a thing as genetic memory that not only gives you the color of your eyes and your hair, but that for some of us, that we inherit memories from those who have gone before us. And they may not be total memories, but I can see it in my two brothers, where one is definitely more like my father's side of the family, and the other is definitely more like my mother's side of the family. And I think that it's not everyone in a family that inherits certain things, but Walter certainly has an incredible amount of compassion, as serious a man as he is. He's a deep-feeling man.
Jane, now, what is it that makes you so not comfortable but able to be around such, like to be around the Holocaust survivors to the point of dating them and to be on Pine Ridge and the different things? What is it within your spirit that makes you able to handle stuff that most people would walk away from?
Absolutely.
I don't know. I think it's what comes into your life that that decides things like that. And I don't think that it isn't like I went looking for it. I mean, I did, okay. I looked for some help for a friend of mine in my town.
Right.
And they happened to find Walter. Well, that's different. In my family, I come from a different time in life now. Both of us are headed towards 70, so we come from when people kept things to themselves a lot. We've watched in our lifetime as people have learned to communicate more with each other,
right,
and bring problems into light.
Yeah.
But there's always been problems for every human being that's been born here. In my family, I had three people that I call hero, and now I've added Walter as a fourth. The first were my grandmother's cousins back in Denmark who, like most Danish people, assisted in rescuing the Jews during the occupation of Denmark. And when I was 14, my father took me over there, and I visited with his older cousin. She and her son had actually built a fake wall in their dining room that they hid people behind until it was dark,
wow,
and then he would put them in his boat and take them over to Sweden. And I thought, and her son was shot numerous times. He had shrapnel all through his body. But I was so taken to have come from a nation of people, because I am mostly Danish.
Yeah.
To have come from a nation of people who valued their own so, because the Danish king said, first you're a Dane, then you are whatever else you want to be. And that's the outlook there. So it wasn't just my cousins who did that. It was almost everyone in Denmark. But so those are the first heroes. Then throughout my childhood in the 1950s, there were a lot of refugees. I was growing up outside of New Haven, Connecticut, in a Yale bedroom community. And there were a lot of refugees that came first from Hungary, and my one brother brought three of them home to hide them. They hid them in our attic. Well, they didn't hide them, you know, from us. We had a room in the attic, and they were welcome to stay there. They had fled from Hungary, and when they got to New Haven, there were still people in New Haven that were after them to kill them. That's war, and that's what war does. And then after that, he brought home some Cuban people, too. But the second hero in my life was my Aunt Carla, who was a hairdresser in a wealthy town. When she was in her late 60s, a chauffeur was driving her home from having done someone's hair in their mansion, and she saw a cop car pulled over to the side of the road, and it looked like the cop was struggling. So my Aunt Carla said to the chauffeur, "Stop the car. We have to help that officer." And she jumped out of the car, and there was a guy holding a pistol, and the officer was bleeding profusely from his stomach. So my aunt, without hesitation, said, "Young man, give me that gun." And he got startled. His hand went up, and she took the gun. She turned to the chauffeur and said, "Flag down the next car. We need help." Chauffeur flags down the next car. It was a priest. My aunt says, You two have your choice. I can stop the bleeding. One of you hold the gun and the other one figure out the radio and call for help." The priest says, "I can't hold the gun." She says, "Don't waste time then. Figure out the radio." She saved the cop's life. It wasn't because she felt it was because it was the thing that was in her to do. It wasn't that she gave it thought. She just did what had to be done. And that is what happens to people. You don't go looking for it, but when something horrendous is in front of you,
right?
If you have any decency, you do it.
Exactly.
And that's what I saw in Walter, was that he was trying 110% to help the people that he loves and cares about.
Yeah.
And so he's a hero to me.
Absolutely.
Pardon me?
We said a whole.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm having trouble understanding you.
That's okay. That's okay. At this point, I'd like to see if David wants to jump in. David, do you have any questions?
I'm listening to this extraordinary woman's account. And you know, I've said on a number of occasions that the true path of a native person is the path of a true human being. And we are listening to an extraordinary and true human being. And I think that's the bottom line to Jane, is that she is an extraordinary and true human being with
right.
a beautiful spirit. And I just wanted to quickly quote something by a professor named Francis Jennings, who obviously long deceased. He wrote a book, and I'm quoting from him because you're from Connecticut, right, Jane?
Yeah.
A lot is known about the more is known about the Western tribes that experienced the Holocaust than is known about the Eastern tribes, as Jane was mentioning before. It ended with history somewhat 300 years ago. Well, Francis Jennings wrote a book called The Invasion of America, Indians, Colonialism, and the Cant of Conquest. And I wanted to quote something that he said, which says, "When assumptions are changed, phenomena appear in new aspects. The facts affirmed in this book will seem strange to students grounded in traditional lore. Some persons may find it incredible that the righteous, God-fearing folk who were their ancestors could have engaged in such practices as are here described, especially the pervasive, calculated deception of the official record. Indians will not share in such incredulity. They have long known that pens could be as forked as tongues." And I just want to express my gratitude that you, Jane, and Walter are on this show today, because we are here to alter perceptions that predominantly are false. You know, we need to hear stories such as Walter's. We need to hear stories such as yours, Jane. Good people of every color and every race that are reaching out to help. And I just want to take this moment to thank you.
Well, thank you. It's a little embarrassing to hear that, but because it's not my focus normally, but I do appreciate it. Thank you. I think that it's a lot of times that it's very angry people that get all of the attention and that distort perception of the group. And it's what I was saying to Walter the other day is that there are so many good people living on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation who are doing their best to have a good life, a respectful life, I should say. And quite often, I feel sorry for the children here that there is so much emphasis put on on negative or unhealthy behavior that the good people are overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
And for the children's sake, I'd like to see more emphasis on the good.
Absolutely.
You must
nurture and positive. If it is the children who are going to lead us into the future, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the numbers of children here who are committing suicide are growing.
Yes.
And
it's an epidemic.
And that's true. But here's some good side of that. Because of this documentary, which is just mind-blowing that it's happened to us, we have met some incredibly good people. I think documentary people in general are very good people because they're not out for the money. They're out to share information. And the woman, there were three filmmakers that came to the house just to bring us some stuff from Randy, or the producer of this documentary. And in sitting having coffee with them, the one was telling me how he was helping some kids at the community college on the reservation because they wanted to go to the children who had been either close to a suicide or had tried to commit suicide themselves. And they were thinking that it might be good to film them and let them tell their story so that they could share that and be heard. And I thought, how wonderful. What a great idea that children are reaching out to each other. And I know the ones at college level, wouldn't want to be called children. But on top of that, the young woman who composed the background music for The Thick Dark Fog, her name is Catherine, she told me how she'd like to come help the kids on the reservation. And in our conversation, she was saying how she had gone to some troubled inner-city kids in Los Angeles and spoken with them one-to-one, asked them to talk to her, and helped them to bring out their own individual song. She created a song with each child that was their own song. And I would love to have that happen here.
Yeah,
because
be
can you imagine how powerful that would be to have your own song? And it doesn't have to be a big song. It's just your own type of words, your own type of melody. What a gift that woman has. But,
yeah.
So those are the good people that I wanted to tell you about.
Mm-hmm. It's so important for stories like Walter's to come out because we are still facing it in our communities today. It hasn't stopped. It continues to grow because there has never been any justification to the actions prior. So although we have people on many levels, some fight for the justice of it, some fight for the healing of it, I truly believe in my perspective that free healing comes with justice. So there has to be some form of justice in the long run. Now, what that justice entails, I don't know. But I do know with stories like Walter's and stories like yours and stories like anyone who this has affected in their life, because it is, it does get handed down from generation to generation. It's who you have made to become. It's how you will now raise your children. So it is effective. I truly believe that for a healing to come within the nations must come back together and they need to educate in truth. Healing begins in the beginning, not in the middle. You must heal at the beginning to get to the end. And I don't believe that we've actually done that as nations. As individual people, some have. Some know how to do it, some don't. And that's when they get lost in the alcoholism and the drug addiction. But it has to be looked at as an entire community problem and not an individual problem. Because if we truly are moving forward, then I do believe it is time to heal with some form of justice.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, I'd like to put Walter on to talk to you about that, because I think he's got a good point of view, better than mine. Hold on.
Thank you, Jane.
The need for the people to heal, and he's talking about from an angle of justice.
Hello?
Hi, Walter. Welcome to Fire Talk.
Hey, how are you?
Very good, sir. It's very good to have you on the show with us today. A couple of months back, we did a show with Randy Vasquez, who did your documentary from your book. And I'm gonna tell you, Walter, I saw the movie. I've ordered your book, and I can tell you, sir, that you have touched the lives of many people with your words. And I am very honored to have you with us today.
Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate talking to you. But it was a hard movie and a hard book. Took many years.
Mm-hmm.
And we finally got it down into one place where we got them all finished. And now it's up to the public and people that are interested in this type of information. It's positive information, just something that we at Lakota people have never experienced before. All of that stuff has been taken away from us.
Right, yeah.
And so in order to heal ourselves, we need something that is very simple. Just like a long time ago, life was very practical and very understandable. Today it's not. And we need to get back into hopefully creating an understanding with words. A lot of our people here on the reservation are beginning to speak English. And I had one experience during a Sundance that I attended. And we were watching the gate, and the elderly person drove up, and I started speaking Lakota to her. And she looked at me and said, "I don't understand." She said, "I speak English." Mm. And it was, I felt the pain deep.
Yeah.
Something I just never expected. And so I began to think about a lot of things like that. The language that we speak today is English. But as far as I'm concerned, as an individual, and this is my own point of view, the English language is a dead language. There's no life to it. And I know you've heard many times people say that we can't translate some of our language into English, some of the things that we do. There's no way that you can translate them. And that's true. It's true because, for an example, the Lakota language has a life attached to it. English has perfect grammar. Lakota, in order to have perfect grammar, you need respect, honor and dignity. And when you have that inside of your soul, and that's part of you, then that's what speaks for you. That's what creates your words. But in English, you've got a dictionary. And a lot of these words are made up from different cultures. They're put together to make it sound good and acceptable and make you sound smart. But it doesn't do anything for you in terms of life. It doesn't create laughter. It doesn't create a good feeling. All it is just spoken. That's all there is to it. But that's not life. Life is having friendship, having respect, having honor, having dignity. That's how you see your friends. That's how you treat your friends. And that's what we learn in, through the Lakota language. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's how I see the language, and I encourage a lot of people to look at the language and try to come to an understanding about it. This is part of healing. And if we lose our language, there is no more Lakota. There is no more human beings. We'll be just a person with no goals. We'll have nothing left, nothing to look forward to. And, you know, I've seen this happen many years. For as long as I can remember growing up, I've seen a lot of people that I went to school with. And I'm sure you've heard it before that people would say, you know, a lot of my classmates are gone. I'm the only one that know that's still alive. But, you know, it's the same thing in my case. I knew a lot of people, a lot of boys in school. Matter of fact, we had five dormitories of boys. We had what they called the Upper East, the Lower East, the Upper North, and the Lower North, and then the West Side. Those were all dormitories, and all those beds numbered in anywhere from 28 to 30 beds in one dormitory. So eventually you get to know every one of those people, all those boys. And then all of a sudden, they're gone, just like that. Just you ask about them, and they'll tell you he committed suicide, or he drank himself to death, or he got killed in an auto accident, or somebody shot him. But when you analyze a lot of that stuff, It's the same old thing. These guys, these boys, grew up into being a man physically, but emotionally and psychologically, they were still little boys. Mm-hmm. They never got past boarding school. That's the after effects of boarding school. Boarding school is a residential school here. Here on the Pine Ridge Reservation, we understand it as boarding school. And then there's the other Jesuit school. We call that, back then we used to call it the Holy Rosary. Today it's called the Red Cloud School. But these are all boarding schools. You go there, they take you there in the fall, and you don't get to go home until summer. And if you're lucky, you get to go home for Christmas. If you behave and you follow all of those rules and regulations that they have. But It was a hard life for us during that time. So a lot of these guys, as far as I can see, they just laid down and died. They just gave up. You know, there was no too much pain in trying to live, or not live, but try to survive.
Yeah.
No matter what they thought about, there was pain. And I found this out by writing down our memories that I wanted to give to my children, because I was estranged from them, and that part I realized. And so Jane helped me on this, and we used our living room. We moved all the furniture back, and we start. One thing I've noticed while we were writing is that I would switch subjects. If something got too painful, then I would switch to another subject. This is fragmented minds, fragmented thinking, and I didn't know that. Hello?
Yeah, Walter, I'm
Yeah, your voice is breaking up.
No, we're
anyway,
here.
Anyway,
yeah.
The fragmented thinking was part of the after effects of boarding school, but also the fragmented hearing. I only heard what I wanted to hear, nothing else. So once we started writing this and putting it down on paper, we began to realize that I was changing a lot of the subject. And Jane said, why don't we cut these things up? We'll put them on the floor. And the whole living room floor was covered with little strips of paper, you know, putting together what we wrote into to create a paragraph. And it took a while to get all of that done. But in the process, I began to realize other things, and so did Jane. And how I was behaving, how I was thinking, how I was acting, how I would say things, how to cover up things. You know, there's in boarding school, you become a very good liar,
mm-hmm.
and that's reality. Because if you don't lie, you get your head beat in. I mean, you don't get spanked. You get to actually get your head beat in. You know, they hold a fist. They make a fist, and the middle finger, they stick that out, and that's what they wrap you on the head with. And if they don't, they wrap you on them behind the head, wherever it hurts. They knew where it hurts. Sometimes it would be, you know, the top of your head, they just pound on that. And
I
used to wonder, changing the subject a little bit, I wondered if they went to school just for that purpose, or if they attended some seminar just to learn how to torture children. But anyway, that was something
that came up along
the way. But
they did go to school. They did go to school.
Ah.
They went to school every Sunday in their churches because that's what taught them that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they starved us on Sundays. Sundays, we never got anything to eat at school. We got a bowl of cereal in the morning, our oatmeal, a small bowl, and maybe a glass of milk, and that was it. And then in the afternoon, they gave you what they called a bun. So we call that the bun time. Well, just a little small biscuit. And that's what kept you going until Monday morning. So Sundays, we call that the starvation day. But I went to church because they used to give us a hot dog and a piece of candy and a cup of coffee. And that was the reason for going to church.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, boarding school is the one that taught us a lot of things. And we've become very good liars. Because if you don't lie, then you got your head beat in or you got slapped around. You were punished in many different ways for breaking what they call school rules. You know, I never knew what the rules were, but that's what they used to accuse us of. But other than that, there was other things that we had become experts at, you know, like running away, stealing food. We knew where the storage was. It was a big underground cellar, but we found ways to get in there. And so we broke into that cellar in order to get what we could, if it was potatoes, if it was onions, or if it was apples, oranges, anything that we could find that was edible. We went in there and we stole it, because that was the way to survive. And we used to take sacks and fill them up with apples or oranges or, you know, lettuce or cabbage, anything that we could find in there. And we would take them out and go up to the boys' building and just pass them out, because we knew they were hungry too. So that's how we survived in school. And other times we went to what they called the school garden. And we stole stuff from there. We'd sneak in there at night and go down, come out of the fire escape, the rusty old fire escape, and you were scared to go down there because you had that feeling that it was going to break off. But we went down there and we'd go down into the garden, fill up our shirts with whatever we would carry, and go back to the building again. So these things... These things that we learned in school, we carried them with us after we left the school and we become adults. Then we still had that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what boarding school was all about.
Did you ever get caught, Walter?
Oh, yeah. I got caught
a
lot of times.
What happened?
Well, they take us into what we called the boys' advisor's office. There was always an office there. And in the old boarding school building, you go up the stairs, and you go into this little level, little place there, and off to the left there was an office, a little building in there. And that was the boys' advisor. He's the one that told us what to do. And they'll take us in there, and they'll ask us, did you take this? And we'd say, yes. And you say, drop your pants. And kneel, bend over and grab your knees or grab your ankles. And they brought out this big board, I'd say maybe 18 inches long, maybe 4 inches wide. And we call that the ape stick. It had holes drilled in it. And that's what they hit you on the hind end with. And if that didn't work, then they had, you know what a coach whip looks like? Flexible
coach
on
whip?
The end. Coach whip. The
oh,
kind
yeah,
that
yeah.
you whip horses with. The long, thin. And there was one of those things hanging there, and that's what they hit you behind the legs with. And the other one was a shorter, flexible. And then they also had a small rubber hose in there. So those are the things that they hit you with. And they used to call that spanking. And after I left school, that's what I used to call it. I was spanked because I stole something. That was my understanding of it until I started in my 50th year when I started thinking about these things. And then Jane brought in a book, Trauma and Recovery, and she was reading that. And then all of a sudden, you know, something just clicked in my mind that all of this stuff was torture and beatings. There was no punishment, just beatings. Because because we were Indians.
Yeah. We interviewed a couple other survivors throughout our shows, and Walter, it's always the same. It's different lands, it's different nations, it's different people, but the brutality of it all is all the same. What I don't, I guess what I'm not understanding is how in today's society we allow it to continue. We know about it. And it continues. You know, you can
yeah,
change.
It continues for the simple reason that on the reservation here, we don't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
We had the education, but it wasn't a good quality education.
Right.
We were forced to speak English, but we never understood the meaning of these words. If you spoke English, you were civilized. And you were supposed to impress anybody that that was non-Indian that came into the school. You had to impress those and show that you were a smart Indian. And so in Lakota, we have the word chante shicha. When you translate that, it means bad heart, but not in a term that your heart is bad. It just means that your heart is sad. And when you compare that to what boarding school is about, we don't have the right words to describe a lot of the beatings, a lot of the torture, a lot of the things that we had to go through. But so a lot of people that grow up and have left boarding school, they never realized what happened to them because of the trauma that they were put through. The trauma, the pain of the trauma itself was so severe that in some cases you forgot you forgot about boarding school. You were glad to survive and get out of there. And so a lot become memory genes for the younger generation. And we don't know how to talk about these things because we never thought about those things that way.
Yeah.
Now, because of the generosity of the Lakota, people supported each other in many different ways. But we just don't have the English words to describe, for an example, complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Like I said, we only have one word. That's chante shita, bad heart.
Yeah.
But that doesn't quite cover what was done at boarding school.
Well,
so those two are complete. What's that?
I was just wondering, what you just said struck a chord with me. Because some of the survivors that we've interviewed and some of the survivors who are speaking for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada are saying that it wasn't that bad. They never saw any of that. So do you think that those children who are publicly speaking now saying, you know what, there were spankings going on, but there was no abuse, there was no violence, no children were being tortured or killed. Do you think those people are still stuck and they just haven't broke through yet?
The denial of what we've seen,
yeah.
Like I said, trauma is so severe.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of it has become blind to these individuals.
Yeah.
They don't see these things because their eyes just can't focus in. And I'll give you an example. I think I was in the third grade, and I remember this very clearly. And we were out for recess, and we came back, and there was one boy that sat behind me, maybe a couple of rows over, but I knew who he was, and we came in, we sat down, and he was laughing. He was sitting back there laughing. Then all of a sudden, I seen the teacher get up. He was a male, and I seen the look on his face. It was just bright red. He picked up this book and he walked over and hit the boy on the side of the head, and knocked him over with a desk and all. And the whole thing just fell over. And I remember all of this dust flying up. And then the whole classroom just went silent. I think they all went into a shock. I mean, this is something that you don't see at home. These things never existed at home. Lakota people don't treat their kids that way. They don't hit their kids. They talk to them and make them understand. But in school, the teacher came and just hit this boy so hard that he just knocked him right over. Now, the shock of that is what covers up a lot of this stuff. And I've talked to a number of the girl students that I remember who were in the same class, but they don't remember those things. And like and in my own example, it took me 50 years to figure this out. And so 50 years, I didn't see anything either until I started putting into the right perspective. Now, this boy got hit so hard that he got knocked over. Now, that I can understand. But back then, I couldn't understand that. It was he was being punished because he wasn't quieten down. He didn't quit laughing when he was supposed to, so he got punished for it. That's how I understood it. But later on, 50 years later, then I began, now when I put it into the right perspective, then I could understand.
Yeah.
Then I could see better. You know, we need right words in order to see things in our culture, because that's how a lot of the younger generations were. I mean, the older generation were raised. They were taught to see things like believing is seeing, and not seeing is believing. So these things were important, but in school it was just completely different, because what they did was they tried to the best way they know how to kill the Indian. And the heck with the child. You know, they didn't try to save the child. They tried to kill the child physically, emotionally, psychologically, any way that they could get rid of them. You know, that's what I had come to understand 50 years later. And that's how long it took for me to create something that I could understand. And I've heard a lot of people from Canada who talked about a lot of these things. And even here, we get the younger generation, when they talk about boarding school, they would say, I've never seen anybody get hit. I've never seen anybody get beat up on. And maybe they didn't, but they were here at school sometimes after the 60s, sometimes after the 70s. Then at that time, things changed. And they did it a lot more sullen. You know, they didn't do it openly like they used to.
Right.
And today, at the boarding school, there's actually a chain-link fence surrounding the whole school. And they claim that it's to protect the children. When we were there, we didn't have a fence. But we were prisoners there. There was an imaginary line that was marked off by streets. So I remember those things, but it took a long time in order it had to be more understandable or more understanding on some of the terms that we used. Back then, the terms that we learned were terms that were taught, that we were forced to accept. Today, as an individual, I can put into terms as a perspective that I can understand. And this is what I'm hoping that this documentary and this book is all about, because I forgot everything that used to be a Lakota. But that was just it. I forgot. But I used everything that I could to remember, even the words of different people, even the styles of other people. I used to watch them and mimic a lot of the things that I thought was the best of people. People are generally good people, positive people. But you have to look at them in a positive way in order to understand them so that you can step forward. It's like the old saying, you know, I've got a foot in the white world, I've got a foot in the red world. What am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. And for me, the answer is very simple. Just pull your feet together and learn how to step forward with what you've learned.
Wow.
These are things that are not the magical things. They're not something that came out of fairyland. These are the reality of life itself. It's just the fact that they tried to turn us into something that we didn't want, that we didn't want to be. And we had to impress people that I had a good, perfect grammar. But that was it. That was a very hollow person. But today, I'm a human being. I can laugh. I can enjoy food. I can even taste food for a change. In school, food was red, green, yellow, brown. We didn't know what the names of the food were. And that's how we grew up until after my 50th year, I finally understood the fact that I didn't know what hamburger tastes like. Today I do. The best part of it is I can enjoy it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
To me, that's what I call a human being. I'm an individual. I finally lived up to what was given to me by the elderly. But elderly, again, is not a human being. Sometimes you will find a six-year-old mind in an 80-year-old body. Other times you'll find an 80-year-old mind in a six-year-old body. So I don't depend on the elderly person. I depend on the elderly of this life, which are the trees, the rocks, the wind, the rain, the sun, even the moon. I depend on them to be educated. But I had to learn how to listen. I had to learn how to hear and understand and interpret what they were talking about. They talk, but not like we do from person to person. They have their own way. They have their own language. And I had to learn how to hear that, and which is very easily. Learn how to sit still and pay attention. Then you can hear these things. So these things are part of my life today. So I try to practice many things in many different ways. I'll give you an example outside of our kitchen window here. I've got an old beat-up bird feeder. It's made up of leftover ply board, some old fence post, and it's not even painted. It's one of the most pitiful-looking bird feeders. But we put in maybe a half a pint of or maybe a pint of bird cedar every day. And we get at least six or seven different species of birds that stay in through the winter. But they have something to eat, so that's how I practice. I give them something to eat. We've got three dogs here that people have thrown away on the roads. We live in a remote area, so people come by and they throw out their dogs. And if we see them, we pick them up, bring them back, feed them, get them healthy, and give them a place to live. They sleep in the house, and they know what the couch is all about. I mean, the couch is so comfortable that all three of them sleep there. And I've got a cat that has been given to us, and but they all have different names that I can remember. You know, like an example, our cat, we call him Pasu. Pasu means nose. But he's also got a last name called Shag Nasty. These are names that I remembered from a long time ago. And then I've got Hootie. Hootie is, his name comes from Hootie and the Blowfish. I like the name Hootie. And Barkley, Jane named him because he barked a lot. But it's called him Barkley. And the other one is a new one. We call him Muttley. Like there's a cartoon character about a dog that flies an airplane and is giggling all the time, and his name is Muttley. So, and this one, he has his own way similar to that. He doesn't fly an airplane, but he's a little corgi. And he's very intelligent. But he showed up on the door, so we took him in and got him back into a healthy state. And these other two dogs, they taught him just about everything that that they grew up with, what they learned. They all learned from a cat. They learned how to hunt just like a cat. And the funny part about our cat is that he doesn't eat mice. He'll hunt for them, but he'll throw them over his shoulder so the dogs can eat them. So these are the things that I learned that, you know, I could translate those things and interpret them to mean something in Lakota. And to share and care and have compassion, that's what this whole, these animals are about. They're all different breeds. They're all mixed breeds, mutts. I call them Heinz 57, but this is what they taught me. And this is what I mean by observing, learn how to interpret as an individual what these animals can do or what nature can do for you. And they'll teach you. They're always there. And I know for a fact that a lot of these trees, they take care of each other, because I could see along the creek. And we've got a little dry creek here in the summertime up until late fall. Then after that, there's water that comes in there. But this creek is called, at one time it used to be called the Mouse Eater's Creek. But this creek earned its own name. And today they call it Mouse Creek. And everybody refers to it as Mouse Creek. But the story behind that is a long time ago, there was an old elderly couple that lived maybe a mile east of us. The husband had lost a lot of his eyesight, and the wife, she stayed home all the time. So in the late afternoons, he would go out visiting, and she would stay home and cook for him. But back then, when they had dogs, they also cooked for the dogs. That went on up until the 1950s. I remember a pot on the stove that was for the dogs. They would have a warm meal in the evening. But the husband had gone visiting, and so the wife cooked up a pot of stew for him. And in the process, she had caught a couple of mice, and there was the pot for the dogs, so she stuck the mice in there and cooked them up for the dogs. So there was two pots on the stove. So when the husband came back, she hollered out from the bedroom that there's a pot of stew there, so sit down and get something to eat and then go to bed. So she got up there early the next morning and went into the kitchen to build a fire, and she noticed that the pot of stew for the dogs was empty. And just about that time, he got up and he was commenting on how good the soup tasted, or how good the stew was. And the stew that she had made for him was still sitting there full. So that's how that name came about. And in the beginning, they called it Mouse Eater's Creek. And then they eventually changed it. The slang changed it just to Mouse Creek. So that's how that whole creek was named. And this creek runs right into Wounded Knee Creek. But anyway, I thought I'd throw in that story.
That's amazing.
How some of these things come about out here, and how boarding school had did a lot of damage to a lot of us, not only on the Pine Ridge, but also other reservations.
Yeah.
And I visited a lot of different reservations in the South, Southwest, a couple of them in California, and then I visited some up in the Canada, United States and Canada, New York area. And I visited some of their reservations there. But I've noticed something similar that we have on our reservation, the vacant look on the young children. Mm-hmm. And you could drive into any village, any agency, and the children will look at you. Teenagers will look at you. They don't see you. All they look for is carrying a compassion. You know, mothers and fathers, they have compassion. They look for their parents so they can see that compassion. And that's the vacant look, that it's not there. And I see it all the time. And it just finally got to the point where, and plus other reasons, I just don't even go into the village anymore unless I have to. Absolutely have to. It just makes me sick. I guess those are the flashbacks that as part of boarding school, or the complex post-traumatic stress disorder, the flashbacks that sets these things off. And that's another thing that I should cover is one of my own experience in terms of flashback, there's a triggering effect, something that sets these off. After my first year in boarding school, the second year I had to ride a bus, big yellow bus. And I remember that bus when it came into Wounded Knee, because all of the people in the community would be there to send us off. But after we got on the bus and we rode into boarding school, I remember pulling up in front of the gymnasium. It was an old, gray, smelly building. Smelled of sweat all the time. They had big, double-wide doors. And so we would stop there, and this bus door would swing open and would hit with a thud. Then all of a sudden, I could smell freshly cut grass and water at the same time. And that smell stayed with me until maybe 2 to 3 weeks, or maybe 10 days, and the smell would disappear. But that smell stayed with me even after I grew up. you slice open a watermelon, and that smell would hit me right in the face, and I would feel sick to my stomach. But I would be back at boarding school as a little child.
Mm-hmm.
And so that smell was the triggering effect. And go fishing, it was the same old thing. I smell that water, and I'd be right back at boarding school. And I would lose all interest in fishing. And I'd be grumpy. I'd be ready to fight and be ready to pound on something. Or I'd just stomp my feet. I'd just walk around and forget about fishing. Just start cussing. So that triggering effect was very important to important for me. That's what helped me to remember other things in this post-traumatic stress disorder. So the triggering effect, I remember one lady, she said that when the church bell started ringing, she would just sit down and start crying.
Wow.
So these were all triggering effects of boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them go through anywhere from 50 to 60, maybe even 100 flashbacks a day, and they don't even know it.
Right.
So that's the sad part of it. And I think this happens to other people on different reservations. The sight of a car, the sound of a car, the smell of food, the smell of the sound of children crying. All of these are triggers to flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything else? I think we're close to our time.
Yeah, we got about 15 more minutes. Walter, I do have one question, and then I want to see if David and Nell has any. My question to you, sir, is the question I ask every survivor I speak to. And that question is that by their own admittance, 50% of the children that they stole died. These children were, they died of many reasons and many causes, yet they all ended up in the same place, in mass graves. So my question to you, being a survivor, being one of these children who lived with them, who knew what they thought and how they felt, do we bring our children home? Do we unearth these mass graves and bring those children home in honor and dignity for the life that they represented? Or do we just move on into the future without addressing that issue? How do you feel on that?
What I had come across, awakened me, growing up from boarding school, or growing up to be an individual after I've dealt with boarding school, one of the things that stood out in my mind was this whole earth is an altar. And you could talk to the Creator from any place that you like, whether it's in the water, above the water, up in the air, under the ground, it doesn't matter. You can talk to the Creator anytime you want. You don't have to go to a building. You don't have to be inside of four walls. You learn to talk to the Creator in your own way, your own terms, your own understanding, and your own mind. That's your choice that was given to you, was given to me. And I realized that this whole earth is an altar. And so I can, my whole family is buried just south of us from where we live on top of the hill. They're not buried in the cemetery. We have our own cemetery. But they're there, so I don't have to go very far to honor them, or do I honor them just by visiting them. And not necessarily say, you should belong here, you should be over here. You know, to me, they're what they call resting in peace, where they're at now. And this is something that I have watched for many years. And I know people have a little confusion on what they should do. But I always say, you know, you do what you feel is best for you. You create your own peace of mind. And by if you want to remove the children and take them to the place where you feel it's best for them, then just go ahead and do it. And don't listen to anybody else. Because once you start listening to other people, and especially churches, because they look out for their own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look out for your agenda. You're the only one that can say, this is what I should do for my children. This is what I should do for my relatives. And as an example, when we started this cemetery, it was done on a temporary basis. My mother passed away in the dead of winter. The roads were so muddy, she wanted to be buried by her mother and father. And I didn't even know where the grave or the cemetery was. I didn't find out until later. So at that time, I said, why don't we just take her out to where we live today, and we'll go up on the hill, and we'll just bury her temporary, and we'll get everything together. Then we'll dig her up, and we'll take her back out there again.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process, after we buried her, the process, my brother said, you know, this is a very good place. And my sister thought that we should just keep her. And for the sake of argument, I didn't want to argue with them. I just went along with what they decided.
Right.
And I eventually learned to like it. But it took a while because the word temporary stayed with me. So today I'm okay with it. But that's how our cemetery got started.
That's an amazing.
So that's what I usually tell anybody to ask me that question. What do you think I should do?
I
just say, you know, do what you feel is best.
Yeah, I just think
do what
that
you feel is best for your family.
I just think that when you lay someone to rest, you lay them to rest with dignity and honor of their traditions and customs, and that we know what lays in mass graves was thrown away after the policies in place were done with them. You know, so there's no honor there where they rest, and there's no, that's just my feeling. I don't feel like there's any honor there. You know what I'm saying? There, it was done in a very thick, dark fog. And it's time to bring those children
home. Yeah, that's
true. That's how I feel, you know.
We have a mass grave here. A Wounded Knee Massacre, all of those, and people were just dug up. I mean, a big trench was dug, and they just threw them in her.
Yeah.
And, no. But people used to come from the northern reservations, Cherry Creek, Cheyenne River, and way up the Standing Rock Reservation. They would come and camp here at Wounded Knee for almost 10 days. And they would go up and visit the mass grave there. And then there was always something to do in terms of honor every day. People would pray. People would sing for them. People would bring them flowers. They would bring them food. And they would leave all of that stuff up there. Sometimes people would just throw money out there. And that was their way that they felt honoring until the religion stepped in there and said, you can't come up here and do that all the time. These people have to rest in peace. So that broke that behavior, the behavior of honor.
Yeah.
And after that, the people never did come back. The last one, I think, was 1949 or 48, somewhere around there. That was the last group that came, and that's what they were told. If you come back, we're going to throw you in jail. So they never did come back after that. So that's how this mass grave ended up here. But we still go up there, and every time it's a Lakota custom to go up there just before Memorial Day and clean up all of the graves, cut the grass and stuff like that, take off the old flowers. And we still do that. We go up there, and so many things have changed because of the new policies, our new way of thinking. People have forgot to honor these people, that they are a part of them. But we try to do whatever we can as individuals here, try to protect them in whatever way that we can.
Yeah.
So,
like
I don't know, it's
does
a hard question, but that's how I usually answer, to keep my own mind clear and my own compassion in place.
I think you answered it beautifully for the situation that you live in, where, you know, in Canada, they come in and took these children out of their village, off their lands, and brought them to different lands. And, you know, so that's the kind of realm I was going at. What you and the Lakota people do, that truly is honor and respect.
Right.
You know, you still control that area.
We always remember those people. We always remember those people, whether they're in Canada or not, because I used to do a lot of ceremonies. And we hang up little flags on the inside. There's seven different colors. The red one stands for all of the red people of the red nation. There's the white nation. There's the black nation. There's the yellow nation. Then there's the green. Then there's the blue. And so all of these things represent different nations of life on this planet. And so the red flag, as far as I'm concerned, stands for the people in Canada, whether they're in the United States. It doesn't matter. There's
absolutely
no boundary lines. They're
absolutely
still part of us. They're still human beings. And so we remember every one of them. So that's another way of practicing compassion for these people. But you know, the spiritual part of this is just, it's a whole new story again.
I don't think we have
time to get into that.
Well, I tell you, Walter, speaking with you, seeing the film, it's, you know, and hopefully when your book arrives to read your book, I do feel that the residential schools failed when it came to you.
Oh, yeah.
Because they did not take your compassion, they did not take your love of your people, and you have found your way back, and you are, I know you don't look at it this way, but you are an inspiration to so many people who face so much trauma in their life, whether it be residential schools or whatever that equals in your life, whatever you had to go through. You found your path back with your life partner, Jane. You've met up with Randy Vasquez, who's brought your life to a beautiful documentary that I can't wait till the whole world starts seeing. Thank you.
Well, I hope people do see it, because I use my life as an example just so that they would understand that the word school is a deception.
Yeah.
It should have been.
It's a mask.
Yeah. But anyway, I hope that they make up their own minds and start looking forward instead of looking back. That behavior is no good to us anymore. We have to look forward.
Well, I certainly agree with you.
The future.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not hard. It just it takes time. It's time consuming, but you just have to keep trying on a daily basis. I call it practicing. I've practiced for so many years that failure is something that I forgot. If something don't go right, I just go back to the starting point and start all over again. And just keep doing that until I come to an understanding. Once I understand, then it becomes part of my life.
Yes.
What a great teaching that is. Well, Walter, thank you very much for joining us. I'm sure David and Nell wants to say goodbye to you, so hold on one more second. David, Nell?
Okay.
I want to thank you, Walter, for sharing your heart and your life with us, and I hope that it reaches the hearts of many people out there who read your book and see the documentary, because the pain and the tears are real, but the healing is also real and can be possible because of wonderful human beings like you. Thank you, Uncle.
Thank you.
Well, we'd love to have you back anytime you're willing to gift us with more of these lessons, because I know the world can definitely use these lessons that you have in your heart.
Well, all you have to do is call Jane and make an appointment, and we'll be here.
I will definitely be doing that.
Thank you very much for letting us be on your show.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You have a good evening.
Send our love to Jane. You too. Thank you, Walter.
We sure will. You can say goodbye to her. She's right here. So.
Yeah, let's say goodbye.
Hang on a second.
Okay. You can hear the show. This is fantastic. I would love to have him back and hear more of the stories that he has to.
Yeah.
Because we need
his
that
teachings,
energy. We need
his
that
teachings energy. Were amazing. His examples were amazing, his teachings.
I know it.
Yeah, it was very,
so
very
pure. As, I don't know if she's, you think she's.
Oh, wait. Walter just handed the phone to
Welcome back.
Welcome back, Jane. We wanted
okay,
to say goodbye
so
to you.
I'm
going to,
I guess that was very kind of you to invite us on. And thank you very much.
And we'd love to have you both back and have Walter back to tell us some more teachings.
Okay.
That'd be fantastic.
All right. Well, we'll stay in touch with you then.
Thank you.
Okay. You have a good one.
You too.
All right.
Thank you, Jane.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well, that was pretty impressive. It's an amazing story. I don't believe now in our travels together that we've actually got to interview someone to that extent.
No.
Who was a survivor of the schools. That was pretty damn amazing.
It was amazing. It's one of those life-changing events that you can't even put into words. It's just,
yep.
You're just so blessed to even be part of it.
Well, I'm very honored to be on that path with both you and David Liligo, interviewing today. And beautiful story. I look forward to getting this out to more people so that they can hear Walter's words. Once again, we want to thank you. Thank you very much for joining us on Fire Talk Productions. Until next week, walk in peace. We're leaving.
I still hate this place, and I don't like it. There's just too many people that went through here that what they learned was violence, hate, resentment, and frustration. And they'll carry that through for the rest of their lives. I am an everyday Lakota man. I live in a small community of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Slowly, I realized the experience in the government boarding school had kept me in a place where I couldn't seem to go forward, backwards, or sideways.
Now the secret is starting to be revealed in the communities, and we're really seeing the extent of this abuse. The Indian boarding schools were part of a misguided effort to try to assimilate Indians into the American cultural and social mainstream. Children are the core of any family, but especially Indian families. And so the attack on the children and on the Indian families was deliberate and effective.
It took my mother and father away.
And
I didn't want them to
leave. Got me down in this real strange chair.
I had to run.
It got me scared.
The matrons called
me. I just started seeing
cutting.
My hair fall on the floor.
Who died so they're cutting all our hair?
We had all our clothes taken from us.
And being hungry. I remember being hungry, always going to bed hungry.
We were being
Everybody
punished, but none of us really knew why.
It wasn't punishment, it was beatings. We got beaters just about everything.
You put your hands there and they slammed the desk down on your hands.
Be handcuffed Everybody to the bedstead.
They take you downstairs and make you kneel down on either a broom handle.
Soap. That's what she used to wash my mouth.
Or a pencil. Oh, man, that
I'll
hurts.
Never forget the burning, the choking, the helplessness, the fading out that I went through.
It wasn't until my 60th year that I began to realize there was more to me. Something was missing. It was like I was a non-being. I didn't know the medical words of multi-generational trauma or the complex post-traumatic stress disorder. So I called the problem what I felt it to be, the thick, dark fog.
So we started writing down his memories. And shortly into it, he reached a block where he had started talking about his boarding school years, and he couldn't keep talking.
It's important that people understand why Indian country is the way it is, why there is all of this social pathology going on in these communities. Like, you can draw a straight line from the boarding schools to alcoholism, substance abuse, the exploitation of children, and violence against women in the Indian community.
Today, Amnesty International releases a report that should disturb every American. Native American and Alaska Native women experience shockingly high rates of rape and sexual assault.
I know I slapped my wife around a number of times, but I've always felt bad afterwards. But it didn't do any good, because it's a behavior that you're not aware of. You don't know it's there. It just happens. Something will set you off. Something will trigger that.
We went to his doctor at the VA hospital, and his doctor said, keep talking. As painful as it is, the key is to keep talking.
There's some people here in this community that are really, you know, healing themselves. There's a movement. In Lakota, we say, Dakush Kaska, it means that something's moving.
Please welcome Walter Littlemoon.
We still have a long ways to go, but every project that we've developed was more or less set up for developing self or self-confidence, a little respect, which was completely destroyed. There was too much drinking, people were dying.
I'm sharing this because so many people living on this reservation and other reservations across the continent still suffer from these things, and I want them to know that it's possible to be free, to gain contentment, and to be a human being.
Life on the Pine Ridge Reservation, in terms of pride, and really in terms of the quality of life, is better because of that man, isn't it?
Now I stand before you. This is my sweat lodge. This is my vision. This is my Sundance.
She doesn't understand. could only stop for a minute. See the world through our eyes. We see things that you never see. Maybe it's not you that's so wise. Now the damage is done. And the damage is done. And you tell us you're sorry, that you want to build a place we both can live. But how can we trust you? You keep doing the same things that you always did. Man sitting on the stool. Just got told his pain isn't worth that much. He's given ridicule. He said, according to our chart, he didn't suffer that much. Shame and guilt pour out, caused by preacher's touch. If you'd only stop for a minute, see the world through our eyes. We've seen things that you'll never see. Maybe it's not you that's so wise. And the damage is done. And the damage is done. Damage is done. And the damage is done.